Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now in Exile. The CIA holds a secret meeting with Taliban leadership in Islamabad. We'll speak with an Afghan woman journalist who is stationed there. Then, who serves on the front line? We'll look at a new report on child soldiers serving both the Taliban and the Northern Alliance, and why the U.S. is delaying military strikes against the Taliban in Afghanistan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report as we broadcast from the first Ground Zero, the second being Afghanistan. I'm Amy Goodman. The House suspended work and three Senate office buildings were closed yesterday as congressional leaders announced that 26 Senate staffers and five police officers have been exposed to anthrax spores that arrived in the office mail of Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. It was believed to be the first time since British troops burned the Capitol in 1814 that danger to lawmakers forced a congressional recess. The letter sent to Daschle was found to contain a highly refined form of anthrax, suggesting it was produced by experts. Producing germs that can spread as a mist has been the main technical challenge facing bioweapons programs throughout the 20th century. Also, almost simultaneously, New York Governor George Pataki announced that anthrax microbes have been detected in his Manhattan office, and over 100 women's health clinics have reported that they've gotten envelopes with powder, one of them testing positive in Florida. Meanwhile, Centers for Disease Control announced yesterday that preliminary testing indicates the strain of anthrax that infected workers at American Media in Boca Raton is almost identical to the strain that arrived in a letter that was sent to NBC anchor Tom Brokaw. Taliban troop concentrations in northern Afghanistan have become a target of U.S. airstrikes for the first time yesterday in what appears to signal a shift in strategy towards the Northern Alliance. A leading British aid agency says it has confirmation of the first starvation deaths inside Afghanistan since the military campaign began. According to Oxfam's Afghanistan director, six people, including three children under age three, died in the village of Halai in northern province. The announcement comes as several aid agencies called yesterday for an immediate pause to all hostilities in Afghanistan, including Western bombing, so humanitarian supplies could be delivered urgently. Winter sets in next month. They said the U.S. attacks were making it impossible to distribute relief because laborers and truckers were afraid to unload food or to stay overnight in towns. Tony Blair rejected calls yesterday by aid agencies and some of his own Labour Party MPs for the coalition allies to halt bombing in Afghanistan in order to let food supplies through. The British Prime Minister said the main problem was harassment and intimidation of convoys by the Taliban and warned that any halt to military action would be interpreted as weakness. Bush administration officials said yesterday they would not override Bayer's patent on anthrax antibiotic Cipro to allow drug companies to produce cheaper generic versions of the drug. Officials did say they would increase the number of antibiotics approved to treat anthrax and the number of companies allowed to produce them, including one in India. Bayer is currently unable to produce the drug in anything near the quantities authorities think they will now need. The move could throw wide open the debate over the cost of medicines in poor countries. Consumer groups said the scare about anthrax should encourage the U.S. government to rethink its position to allowing poor countries to produce generic versions of drugs, especially for AIDS. Two members of the Bush cabinet are former drug company officials. Mitch Daniels, director of the Office of Management and Budget, was a top executive at Eli Lilly, while Donald Rumsfeld ran Searle Pharmaceuticals, now named Pharmacia. And President Bush used the September 11th attacks yesterday to press for a quick vote on new authority to negotiate trade agreements without allowing amendment by the Senate. He said the terrorists attacked the World Trade Center will defeat them by expanding and encouraging world trade. Opponents of the bill say Bush is trying to force it through by wrapping it in the attacks. And the Chinese deployed 10,000 police and military personnel while fighter jets patrol closed airspace over Shanghai as the city prepares to receive President Bush and the 20 other heads of state for the annual APEC summit. That's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. The U.S. and allies will likely try to use the forum to gain support from Muslim countries and China for its so-called war on terrorism. The Chinese foreign minister announced today that Pacific Rim nations agreed to combat terrorism in a fight between justice and evil, as APEC prepared a statement that carefully avoids any mention of the U.S.-led attacks on Afghanistan. Canadian Minister of International Trade Pierre Pettigrew said yesterday the attacks on the United States have lent new impetus to the launch of a round of liberalization talks at the World Trade Organization. And the New York City Board of Education unanimously adopted a resolution last night to require all public schools to lead students in the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of every school day and at all school-wide assemblies and events. The resolution is essentially a copy of a New York State education law already on the books, but education officials say the requirement to recite the pledge has been all but ignored at most New York City schools for much of the last 30 years since the waning days of the Vietnam War. The New York Civil Liberties Union objected strongly to the proposal, noting that the New York City school system has many students who are not American citizens. It said those students are likely, quote, to be scapegoated or targeted for harassment if they do not participate. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Taliban troop concentrations in northern Afghanistan became a target of U.S. airstrikes for the first time yesterday in what appears to signal a shift in strategy towards the Northern Alliance, paving the way for the opposition fighters to launch a fierce assault on the city of Mazar. Last night, Alliance forces seemed to be closing in on the town, with thousands of troops amassing just a couple miles south of the city. The city is the most fiercely contested place in Afghanistan in recent years and the site of some of the worst massacres in the Afghan Civil War. Its fall would mark a watershed in the seven-year-old conflict and could see the Taliban driven out of northern Afghanistan. Yesterday, the Taliban foreign minister, Mullah Waqil Ahmed Mudawakil, met with CIA officials in a top-secret visit to Islamabad. According to senior sources in Pakistan, the Taliban foreign minister, who's regarded as a moderate, offered a last-minute deal to hand over Osama bin Laden during the visit to Islamabad. There were also indications yesterday that he met CIA agents, representatives of the former king of Afghanistan, Zafar Shah, and touted as a possible figurehead of any post-Taliban administration and a representative of the opposition Northern Alliance. The foreign minister offered to hand over bin Laden for trial in a country other than the U.S. without asking to see evidence implicating bin Laden in the attacks and returned for a halt to the bombing. This according to a source close to the Pakistan military. We're joined on the telephone right now by Fariba Nawa, who is a reporter for Agence France-Presse. She's in Islamabad now. We interviewed her when she was in Brooklyn. She is an Afghan reporter reporting from Pakistan. I spoke to her just before the program aired and asked her about the United States not bombing the front lines of the Taliban forces, which has made the Northern Alliance begin to question why the U.S. is not moving faster, and why the U.S., if they were to hit the Taliban troops, would allow the Northern Alliance to go through to Kabul, something they don't seem to want to do right now. This was a response of Fariba Nawa.
I think the delay has to do with negotiations with the former king in Pakistan in deciding what a post-Taliban government will be, and until they're sure of what the next step is. Because once they attack the Taliban don't have much in terms of artillery and machinery to fight. They're banking on their men once the ground troops are inside. Once American ground troops are inside Afghanistan, they are hopeful that their men will fight, but not their weapons, because they don't have many weapons, and right now the U.S. has destroyed many of their military installations. So the U.S. knows once it's weakened the Taliban, it's very likely that they will fall. Right now what else is happening is that commanders are being bought off. The commanders are being paid off, I think. There are reports, we don't know by who necessarily, but they're being paid off to change sides. And in the western region of Afghanistan, Ismail Khan, who's the opposition commander there, he told me yesterday that he's hoping to take the province of Badghis and Nimruz and these other provinces by peaceful means and negotiations with the Taliban. And I'm assuming that also involves monetary means, giving them money to come to the other side.
In the negotiations that the U.S. is doing with Pakistan, General Powell just meeting with General Musharraf, the head of Pakistan, is Pakistan pushing for the Taliban to be a part of the new government?
Yes, absolutely. They keep calling them the moderate Taliban, and we're all scurrying around trying to find out who the moderate Taliban are. The foreign minister, Wakil Mutawakkil, is missing. And I think one of the news agencies here was able to get an interview with him. We're not sure, but he is believed to be defecting, or there are rumors that he's talking with Pakistan about a coalition government involving the moderate Taliban. There is a schism among the Taliban. They're not monolithic. And I think that some of them are rethinking their ideology at this point. And that's what the U.S. is hoping for, is that they will have some Pashtun Taliban support in their coalition against terrorism.
So the U.S. is overthrowing the Taliban government for a Taliban government?
That's an interesting way to put it. I don't think they want to call the post-Taliban government a Taliban government, but they want to include members, individuals who they call who haven't committed atrocities and criminal acts to become part of the post-Taliban government. Yes, they realize the importance that the Taliban have some support, if not in Afghanistan necessarily, but in Pakistan, and the U.S. will need them for any kind of peaceful government afterwards. It's not enough just to have non-Taliban Pashtuns. They want Taliban Pashtuns to be part of the representative government.
What is the word going around right now about the top-secret CIA meeting with the Taliban foreign minister?
I haven't been up to date on it, so I couldn't tell you, but I don't know what the answer to that is, to be honest with you. Mutawakkil is a very important person in the Taliban government, and if he agrees to work with the U.S. or Pakistan, it will mean something significant, in that perhaps a lot more Taliban members will join him, and the movement will mean something else altogether. I think the significance of that is, but right now that's at a preliminary stage, and as far as I know, the fact that he is even negotiating is a rumor. So
the reports are that is where the Taliban for the first time offered to hand over bin Laden for a trial in a third country without seeing the evidence first.
Yeah, there have been reports of that. But the U.S. has continuously said, no, we're not going to show you the evidence because it's a security risk and intelligence risk. We showed you the evidence in 1998 when he was accused of bombing, when Osama bin Laden was accused of bombing the embassies in Africa, and you didn't do anything about it. So why should we show you this now?
But the difference now is they're saying that the Taliban are offering to turn him over for a trial in a third country without seeing the evidence first.
Right, that's what we heard. Honestly, from my analysis and from my reporting, I don't think the Taliban have power over Osama bin Laden. I think Osama bin Laden is in charge of the Taliban right now, and the Taliban are grasping at straws at what they can do.
Fariba Banoa, you are now in Islamabad. You're an Afghan woman reporting in Pakistan. Can you describe what the scene is there on the ground?
In Islamabad, it's sort of a journalist's zoo. The hotels here are booked. Taxis are a bit hard to find because they've been rented out by journalists. As an Afghan, I think it's very difficult for me to keep a distance and report like all the other reporters are doing so, because every time a bomb falls, I think about my family and relatives inside Herat, where I'm from, and it has been bombed continuously since the beginning of these strikes. I have no contact with them. I've been told they're fine by other relatives, but just generally, there's a lot of emotions that I have, and we're working around the clock. There's no break. There are no days off. So I think it's just a bit exhausting and emotionally draining at this point. I'm tired of seeing my country at war, and I'm glad that I'm here reporting on it. And I think it's very significant that, because I speak the languages, a lot of what you will get are third-rate news reports, because they have to hire people to speak the languages of the area, and they normally hire Urdu-speaking Pakistanis, who in turn hire Pashto or Farsi speakers, the languages of Afghans, to give them information. So what comes through on the mainstream media is, like I said, third-hand information. So I'm lucky enough to talk to these commanders in my own language and then directly translate as I'm speaking to them and know what's going on. I've had a difficult time with the Taliban. They haven't warmed up to me nor spoken to me much. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because I'm a woman, or perhaps because I don't speak the languages that they do. I don't speak Pashto. So I hope.
The last story you wrote, what was it about?
The last story I wrote was yesterday. Well, actually, today I wrote about an opposition commander. He is a member. He is the leader of Hizb al-Wahdat, which is the Hazara Shiite group, the group most persecuted by the Taliban. The villages have been burned down, entire villages, massacres, according to human rights organizations. And he was telling me that he's willing to work with the moderate Taliban as well, which is quite surprising to me, because Hizb al-Wahdat is vehemently opposed to any Taliban leadership, any Taliban coalition, any involvement of the Taliban, any future government of Afghanistan. But it seems like that the Northern Alliance and the United States understand the importance of the Taliban being part of Afghanistan's future.
Fariba Nawa, what about the protests that have been taking place throughout Pakistan?
The protest today, I have not heard much. We've been doing stories in the last couple of days. I think it's been fairly quiet. On Monday, there was a strike, a boycott. The religious groups had called for a boycott, so that meant all the shops were closed. Many offices were closed in an anti-war, in their activities. They haven't been very active in the last couple of days. People have been killed near the base in Karachi, in Jacobabad, where the U.S. has a military presence there. The Pakistanis are vehemently opposed to any Americans inside Pakistan, whether it's their weapons or their men or their troops. So I think that the demonstrations have become less and less noisy, shall I say. And what I was talking to people on the street, the women, the most Pakistanis as well as Afghan refugees, the overall sentiment is we oppose the bombings. We are for peace. We need to find a nonviolent solution to this. But at the same time, Pakistanis recognize what a difficult position Pakistan has been put in, and they actually support their president, General Parvez Musharraf. So they're sort of torn on that end. I'll ask them, how do you feel about the war? U.S. should not be bombing. How do you feel about Musharraf supporting the U.S.? And their answer is, well, Musharraf had no choice, which is interesting.
And what about Afghan refugees? How many were able to get into Pakistan, and where they are now in Pakistan?
There are no confirmed numbers because the borders are closed, so there are no official counts. And most of the refugees are coming through the mountain passes with the help of smugglers. And there have been camps set up in Quetta and Peshawar, which are the bordering cities. So many are coming, but not in the numbers that they had suspected. I think if they open the borders, they'll get the million or 1.5 million that they were expecting. But the borders are closed at this point, and Pakistan has said that we're not going to be able to help these refugees. If they're supporting efforts to build camps inside Afghanistan on the other side of the border so that these refugees could stay inside Afghanistan. On the other hand, they're also going to Iran as well. Iran has made more of an effort to help them with the internally displaced camps. But I spoke to a cousin of mine in Iran, and he was saying that nobody's going to these camps. They're all coming through the mountain passes and desert, crossing the border into Iran. It's not that difficult to get through.
And finally, in terms of your mentioning your different approach to the news, being that you're Afghan, that you can talk a lot of the languages there, you can talk directly with people. What is the focus of the reporters around you, and how does it differ from what you're able to get?
Well, a specific example, I hate the word fundamentalist. I think it's a loaded term. I think I'm a little more sensitized to how I want my stories to be perceived, what they should say. I'm very careful about the wording. And I think other reporters may not be as careful. I think, obviously, I have a personal gain, or I have a personal issue with all this, and many of the other reporters here, this is just another story for them, or it's the story of the century for them, or it's a career opportunity for them. For me, it's none of those things. So I feel, I'm not sure if I'm doing better reporting than they are. But I am more careful of how I want things to be perceived because I do have an understanding of the area and the region, and I am from here. So I think that the Muslim world has been misrepresented by the media continuously, and I still think that some of the reports I'm seeing are inaccurate.
We interviewed a representative of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan, and she was talking about how the Northern Alliance is as guilty of abuses of women as the Taliban. Of course, they were all fighting together as the Mujahideen against the Soviets. What is your sense of that?
I think there are different ways of how they treated women. I think when the Taliban were there, it was a systematic, governed persecution of women. When the Northern Alliance was in power, there was no law. It was lawlessness, and as a result, women were raped and killed, and their honor was taken away from them. So, and the groups that did that should be punished for it, just as the Taliban should be. However, I think that if they are in power again, I don't really know. They are just as guilty. I mean, General Rashid Dostum, who is from Mazar-e-Sharif, the Uzbek leader, he has been accused of many atrocities against women as well as other civilians. So, and as I speak to the commanders, to the opposition commanders, I always ask this question, that you had your chance in power, and you killed your own people and you kept fighting. Why should we give you another chance? And their response is, and it's unanimous among all of them, is we know what mistakes we made and we won't make it again. But whether we should believe them or not, and no, I'm pretty skeptical about them being in power again. I think there are certain commanders who mean well and who have a people agenda, who really care about what they're doing and about the people. I think Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was martyred, was one of those people. But for the most part, as an alliance, it's really not an alliance nor a united front, which is what they're calling themselves. And some of them will admit to that and say our only bind right now is having a common enemy, the Taliban.
Naweeba Fawa speaking to us from Islamabad, Pakistan. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute, and we'll come back to the United States, where we'll hear from a Pakistani scientist who's at Princeton University who spoke at an anti-war rally this past weekend. Then we're going to take a look at who is on the front lines, child soldiers, both on the front lines of the Taliban and the Northern Alliance. And we're going to take a look at here in this country, who goes to war, who dies. Stay with us. Edwin Starr here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, India has accused Pakistan of unprovoked heavy firing from across the international border of Kashmir. This after Pakistan said yesterday its military is on full alert and ready to retaliate following troop movements on the Indian side of the de facto border that divides the disputed province of Kashmir. Pakistan's warning, which follows Indian shelling of Pakistan positions across the Kashmir line of control on Monday and Tuesday, and a Pakistani response, have increased concerns about the dangers of a more substantial military standoff between the two nuclear-armed rivals. It follows a visit to the region by General Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, that was intended to cool passions between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. But clearly, tension is higher than before the Secretary of State's arrival. Well, this past weekend, there was an anti-war rally in New York. Tomorrow we'll be playing the speech of the Reverend Al Sharpton. Today we're going to go to Zia Meehan, who is a research scientist at Princeton University. He comes from Pakistan.
I'll keep my remarks brief because it's a nice sunny day. And I think we actually need to move quickly beyond listening to each other and talking to those who are not listening to us. When Amy was introducing me, she talked about George Bush saying that this was the first war of the 21st century. This war has been 50 years in the making. This war is a direct legacy of US policies during the Cold War. This war is a consequence of the fact that 50 years ago, when Israel was created and the Palestinians dispossessed, nobody talked about justice. It's a consequence of the fact that 50 years ago, a democratic government in Iran was overthrown by the CIA because they wanted to take oil and use those profits to feed and clothe and house the people of their own country rather than create profits for U.S. oil companies. This war is a consequence of the fact that for 50 years across the Arab world, across the Third World, whenever people spoke up saying we want social change, we want justice, we want to decide our own lives, we want democracy, the United States government used a different measure. Their measure was not democracy, but whether that government could be bought off to support the United States and oppose the Soviet Union, and the people be damned. So when you close off democracy, when you close off the possibility of progressive social change, when you leave people starving and poor in the countryside, in the slums, where cities like Cairo and Egypt have slums of millions of people who live on less than a dollar a day, what options do they have except to get mad? The second part of what's caused this present crisis is the fact that for year after year, the Arab and Muslim world has seen the United States stand with Israel while the Palestinians suffer and are killed. The first Palestinian Intifada was a long time ago, and they watched and watched, and nobody did anything. How many people remember that next year will be the 20th anniversary of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon? More than 10,000 people were killed by the Israelis in that war where they bombed Beirut. That was the first time that I actually watched on television what we are all seeing now, aeroplanes bombing cities. And the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Arabs and the Muslims said, please do something. Civilians are dying, innocent people are dying, do something. And the United States urged restraint. And when the United Nations tried to intervene, the United States blocked it in the Security Council. No wonder everybody decided that there were two standards, those for America's friends and those for America's enemies. Now what we've seen with this terrible attack on New York and on Washington is a handful of people trying to take advantage of the anger and the resentment that has grown across the Muslim world, because no one has left any avenue for them to speak out against their own undemocratic, repressive governments. You look at the government of Egypt, it only stays in power because the US gives it guns and money. You look at the government of Saudi Arabia, it only stays in power because the US gives it guns and money. You look at the government of Pakistan, which will now only stay in power because the US will give it guns and money. What are the people supposed to do when you close off all avenues to exercise their own demands to control their own lives? Along will come people who will offer them spectacle instead of politics. They will offer them suicide as an alternative to the slow, patient, difficult struggle towards justice. And it's no surprise that in all these millions, there are some who think, enough. This is better than nothing. And one of the great dilemmas we face is that for 50 years, the world has tried to explain to America its pain, and America has not listened. Now the world wants America to feel its pain. And I think it's a tribute to the fact that there are good, kind, merciful, compassionate people everywhere, that in all these countries you're seeing demonstrations against Osama bin Laden, where people say that you don't kill 5,000 innocent people for any reason. Islam doesn't justify it. Politics doesn't justify it. The Palestinian struggle doesn't justify it. You don't kill thousands of innocent people. Now the question is, what will America do? And I think there are three tasks that we must all confront. And they're difficult tasks, but they're tasks we must confront. The first is there are as many people over there watching jugglers and acrobats as here thinking about politics. This is a society that has been conditioned to spectacle and entertainment as opposed to reflecting on its role in the world and what its government does. We are being given the bread and circuses of modern empire, and we have to refuse both. The second part is that the bombing has to stop. This must be our first and immediate demand. The bombing must stop. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Mary Robinson, asked this publicly yesterday. Please at least suspend the bombing so we can feed the 7.5 million starving people in Afghanistan. 7.5 million. The US is dropping food, 37,500 rations, each ration enough to feed one person for one day. What happens to the other 7.5 million? You have to stop the bombing so we can feed innocent people who are caught between the rock and the hard place, with the Taliban on one side and the US Air Force on the other side. Yesterday it was announced that Kofi Annan was given the Nobel Prize, along with the United Nations, for peace. I think it's now time for them to earn that prize. They're here in New York. If the United Nations will not stand up for innocent people caught in a war between Men Without Mercy, Osama bin Laden on one hand with his crusade, and George Bush with his crusade against evildoers on the other, who will? And I think the first thing is that we must make clear that the United Nations must intervene. We must demand a suspension of the bombing and for Kofi Annan to go and talk both to George Bush and to the Taliban and say, look, enough have died already. Enough in New York, enough in Washington, enough in Kabul, enough in Kandahar. No more victims on any side. Thank you.
Zia Amin, Pakistani research scientist at Princeton University in New Jersey, speaking this past weekend at the anti-war rally in New York City. And we want to know what you're doing around this country in this time of war. Tomorrow we're going to be playing some of the comments of people who have called in over the last few days. We'd like you to let us know your name, where you're calling from, what station you listen to, and what kind of organizing you're involved with, either with a group or by yourself. You can call us at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You can also call there if you have a Mac, laptop, or desktop you can offer us. We're putting together our equipment for this unprecedented broadcast of public media, joining together the internet, public access stations, and radio. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. Again, that number, 212-209-2999. We'll be back in a minute.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way.
Universal Soldier Buffy St. Marie from the CD Generations of Folk, Protest and Politics here on Resistance Radio, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the rest of the hour, a discussion on who actually fights and dies in the military. We'll start in Afghanistan and then come home. There's been little explanation by the U.S. media of just who the bombs are hitting, other than naming the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. As the Northern Alliance prepares to launch attacks on cities in northern Afghanistan, recently hit by U.S. attacks, there's been little attention paid to just who will do the fighting. A new report by the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers warns that all sides in Afghanistan are putting children on the front lines, just as UNICEF has been noting that children are suffering the most from Afghanistan's humanitarian catastrophe. It's children who may suffer most from the U.S. bombing of Taliban forces and expected fighting between Taliban and the Northern Alliance. We're joined now by Rory McGovern, who is with the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers in London. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning. Thank you.
So what did you find?
Well, the involvement of children in the conflict in Afghanistan is nothing new. I mean, all warring factions since the time of the Soviet invasion right through to the current civil war have used children as soldiers extensively. What we've seen in recent years has been a greater differentiation in the role that children perform. Many of the religious schools, the madrasas, the mosque schools in Pakistan, are aligned with Islamist parties and networks that in turn have supported the Taliban or one warring faction or another. You know, periodically, those madrasas will turn over young students for a period of military experience, of military service. Often it's short term, often it's just for a few weeks. Often they're kept in a support role than a frontline role. But many of them come back conditioned or brutalized by the experience and in turn have become involved in some of Pakistan's own internal conflicts. The same situation applies on the Northern Alliance side, particularly last year as the Northern Alliance's military position worsened. There was a real step up in conscription, forced recruitment, adults, but also children in provinces like Panjshir and Badakhshan. So it's clear that children are there. They're bunkered down. They're on the front line on both sides and at significant risk in the current military situation.
The Taliban has denied using children. A representative told a visiting Danish delegation November 1997 that all men aged over 18 can become soldiers. And then you have Mullah Muhammad Omar decreeing that any followers who are too young and who are not yet growing a beard must leave his fighting militia, although that doesn't mean they're 18.
I think this was significant and reflects actually some degree of sensitivity on the part of the Taliban to this issue. Now, the Taliban haven't been ready to respond on many human rights issues, as we know. But when they stood accused of this, they did respond. They did make this commitment. It's their own interpretation of age, boys without beards being, I guess, boys before puberty and probably, you know, only 14 or 15 years old. But nevertheless, it is a sign of responsiveness. And many organizations, including ourselves, UNICEF and others, have been really trying to build upon that and ensure that the Taliban do stop the recruitment of children and keep children back from the front line. And there have been some signs of this, that children had been confined more to patrols, more to guard duty in places like Kabul, to free adult soldiers for the front. But obviously, you know, in the current situation of military crisis, it could well be all hands on deck, increased recruitment, increased conscription in the provinces, really to bolster the numbers. The Taliban have about 40,000 in normal circumstances. They can raise their force level to about 100,000 for a short period.
Can you talk more extensively about the Northern Alliance and children?
The Northern Alliance, you know, as we know, is comprised of a number of different groups. Some of those, you know, took the form of parties. You know, certainly during the early phase of the interim government in Afghanistan, the coalition government, and the early part of the civil war, many of those parties, I mean, particularly General Dostum's Junbesh, based out of Mazar-i-Sharif, had, you know, extensive youth movements attached to it for the groups that have certainly been fighting it out from the Panjshir Valley in recent years. They've been in a fairly desperate military position. They have a very limited population base to draw on. It's a situation of total community mobilization. There's been very little differentiation in terms of age, in terms of the roles and responsibilities that children are asked to take on. I think it's very important to widen our focus on this issue, because it's not just the Afghan forces that are using children as soldiers, but many of the Western powers, the United States and the United Kingdom in particular, also recruit below 18 to their militaries. Not only do they recruit 16 in the case of the UK, 17 in the case of the US, but they deploy them into operations. And, you know, certainly 17-year-olds fought it out in the Gulf War, and there have been, you know, several cases of 17-year-old British service people being killed, you know, in conflicts of recent years. So those forces deployed in the region now by the US, by the UK, probably also include significant numbers of child soldiers.
In fact, isn't that partly why the U.S. wouldn't sign on to the Covenant on the Rights of the Child for that reason, and because the U.S. wants to be able to execute minors?
It was one of the issues, you know, that's been a sticking point for the U.S. and the whole child rights debate. The U.S. did sign a new optional protocol which would require it to stop deploying 17-year-olds in combat last year. This was a really, you know, important sign that maybe policy on this would change. But unfortunately, the ratification process hasn't been completed, so it's not clear whether that policy is being applied today in practice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Britain. Again, the report, Special Briefing, Child Soldiers and the West Asian Crisis. Where can people find it on the web?
Our website is www.child-soldiers.org.
Rory McGovern, thank you. Well, as we wrap up the program, we've just discussed the kind of soldiers who are fighting in Afghanistan. Now we're going to take a look at just who is fighting in the U.S. Army. In a minute, we'll go to Chris Appie, author of Working Class War, American Combat Soldiers in Vietnam. But first, we go to Asif Ullah of the War Resisters League, who works with the Roots Program, countering military recruitment efforts in communities of color, to talk about what the U.S. military looks like today. Asif, what does the all-volunteer military look like? Who is in the U.S. Army?
In terms of the Army, it's primarily, you know, people from poor and working class backgrounds. It's in terms of percentage, women make up a larger percentage in terms of women of color in the Army than white women do. They make up about 45% of women in the Army. And in terms of all divisions combined, it's 31% people, 31 to 39% people of color, and of those, the breakdown again is gender-wise, predominantly men in most of the forces except for the Army.
And how does the military try to recruit in communities of color?
Through very clever and creative advertisement campaigns. There's a new advertisement campaign that focuses specifically on Latinos. They've done their research very well, so they target families of Latino youth. Spike Lee had signed a contract with the Navy, a multi-million-dollar contract, where, according to one senior advertisement official, he's able to reach an audience that we usually don't have access to. And so a lot of these advertisements depict young people of color playing basketball and doing essentially things that are now being termed as an army of one, where you can be an individual as well as, you know, serve a larger good.
And what about overall in poorer communities? Is there a different recruiting approach than to the general population?
Sure. The draft has always been an economic draft for young people of color, for poor and working class people, and that's always been something that has been a luring point. The GI Bill, which promises $50,000 when indeed, people, the average who receives that money is actually 2%. The majority receive $23,000, and that's actually about 15% that receive that money. That's dependent on whether or not someone gets an honor roll discharge. A lot of people end up not getting an honor roll discharge. And also on the ASVAB test, which is a requirement before you join the military, and that also determines what your rank and place is going to be in the Army and how much you qualify. So that's one tactic, the GI Bill money for education. There's also a lot of promises about health insurance, about a pension plan, and so on. Discipline that they offer, a certain structure that young people may feel that they're lacking, as well as an opportunity to escape the, you know, the harsh realities that young people exist in, and oftentimes it becomes an option between prison and the military for a lot of young people, poor young people of color.
Asif Ullah is with the War Resisters League, and Chris Appy, also with us, author of Working Class War, American Combat Soldiers in Vietnam. As Asif was just describing the modern-day military, how does this compare, Chris Appy, to the military of Vietnam, meaning the U.S. Army that was fighting in Vietnam?
Well, the Vietnam War was fought under a draft system, but it was a draft system that was not created to be universal. It was actually formed in the early days of the Cold War at a time when war planners realized that it was very unlikely that the next or future wars would require full mobilization of ordinary ground soldiers, but would also require all kinds of scientists and technicians to build fancy weapons and a nuclear arsenal. So they created a very elaborate draft system with many exemptions and deferments, which actually served to channel basically working class and poor people into the military, and people, more prosperous young people, into higher education, where it was thought they could serve the national interest by fulfilling these technical and scientific needs of the modern military. So the result is that, you know, in Vietnam, about 80% of the people who served were poor or working class. Yeah, I could talk about some of those deferments and exemptions if you like.
What's
interesting is that virtually every one of them had a built-in bias against the poorest young men in the country, even the ones you wouldn't expect to. I mean, medical exemptions you might think would go to poor people who had less access to medical care over the years. But in practice, the people who got medical exemptions were almost always those who could show up at the draft center with or the induction center with notes from their private doctors attesting to one physical ailment or another, whereas poorer kids who would show up would be sort of put through the cattle call and given 1A status. Even, you know, hardship deferment, you had to show that military service would cause a change of circumstance resulting in economic hardship to a member of your family that was dependent on you for support. So if you were an unemployed kid with a mom on welfare, military service would actually improve your economic circumstances and allow you to send more money home, whereas if you were better off, military service would actually be an economic hardship. There's sort of this famous case of George Hamilton. Do you remember him, the movie actor, the sort of B-movie actor?
Yes.
He was supporting his mother in his mansion, and when he was drafted, he was able to show that he would go from earning $17,000 a month to $176, so he actually got a hardship deferment. Of course, the most obviously class-biased deferment was the student deferment, which allowed people who could afford to go to college to stay out of the military, or, you know, or at least to put it off for 4 years or longer.
We just heard Asif talk about the role of the media and the PR of the military in the makeup of the modern military. How did it work in Vietnam?
Well, I mean, in some sense, the whole Cold War culture served to recruit people into the military with, World War II being the great model of the good war, and the John Wayne movies that kids grew up on, followed up in the early 60s by John Kennedy's very influential Charge to Service, which affected really the whole generation. But they did, they did lots of recruiting in the neighborhoods, and in that sense, it's probably not all that different from the way it is now. I mean, a lot of kids did volunteer for Vietnam. basically, you know, two-thirds of the people fought in Vietnam were at least technically volunteers, though about half of those were really induced by the draft. They knew the draft was inevitable and tried to have some choice over which branch of the service they would enter.
And then there's the issue of what happens to soldiers when they come home. I mean, in New York City, I think the estimates are something like a third of the homeless on the streets are Vietnam veterans.
Well, I mean, there's no question that the men who fought in Vietnam were really betrayed by the government in terms of the kinds of benefits and help they would receive when they got home. It was, you know, so different than it was for the generation that came home from World War II. The VA system really was a disgrace in the late 60s and 70s.
And after the Persian Gulf War, many soldiers suffered from Persian Gulf War syndrome and still feel that they're not taken care of. And that may go to a very important issue of today, which is the issue of the anthrax vaccine.
Right, yes. You were talking to someone earlier about that?
Yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, the care, you know, it's sometimes now in popular mythology thought that it was the anti-war movement that rejected and scorned returning veterans. But the real rejection was the rejection that they received from a government who didn't really attend to their exposure to Agent Orange, their educational opportunities, job training, and were slow to acknowledge even the existence of post-traumatic stress disorder. And took them many years to actually treat it as a psychological problem. Typically, they would just dispense drugs in the 70s.
Asifullah, how are you countering recruiting today?
One of the things we're encouraging a lot of young people to do right now in the aftermath of September 11th is not give their names to lists that are going around and being used by recruiters to recruit young people into the military. So particularly young people under 18 who are in high school are being asked to sign lists that they're not exactly privy to what those lists are for. Recruiters have been using this as a platform to recruit, contrary to like a lot of the media frenzy that there are. Is a great, you know, there's a great willingness on the part of young Americans to join the military. There hasn't been any upsurge in military recruitment. The numbers have been steady since September 11th. They haven't gone up at all. So that's one of the things we're encouraging young people. We're also working on a video project to counter military recruitment where we interview a lot of young people who've been through the military and talk about their experiences. So we're going to be doing some video screenings throughout the country.
Asifullah, since we have to go right now, what is the website where people can get information?
Warresistors.org, and people should also check out AWOL, Hip Hop Magazine, and CD.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Asifullah of the War Resisters League and Chris Appy, who's written the book Working Class War, American Combat Soldiers in Vietnam, and that does it for this hour. You can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! As well as at webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA, Free Speech Radio News producer Aaron Glantz as well. Thanks to everyone at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno and all our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. Thanks to Downtown Community Television, our hosts. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report.
Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported.
Michael, my dear. Come say that I'm about down.